Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
Listen, Nerd Right Radio!
Nerd Alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 18 of Nerd Pride Radio. 18, an unlucky number in China, because according to Chinese tradition, the 18th circle of hell is the lowest and most torturous. No one returns from the 18th circle of hell. So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome! My name is Mike Jones, and I am a D&D nerd, a sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, a computer nerd, movie nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, and there's also seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my head anymore. As always, you're listening to the best-smelling podcast on the internet. That's right, Nerd Pride Radio smells like Monty Cook's beard. First thing we're going to do today, though, some feedback. Yeah, I'm telling you what, this is just me feeling good about the podcast. Nothing big, I am just getting positive commentary on the feedback from total strangers. This is huge. Pretty much everyone so far who comments, who sends in stuff, I pretty much know who they all are or I have a good idea. But now I'm getting a couple from complete strangers. I have no idea who they are, and I'm so glad you guys are listening. This is awesome. I went and looked at my stats, and I'm telling you, in the first week that a podcast is released, I'm getting 100 unique downloads. Now, that's not big shakes for most people, but for me, 100, well, that's huge. I am on my way to superstardom. So I am very, very happy. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you for helping me make this podcast what it is. I appreciate everything, and I'm having a great time doing it. So we will enjoy the ride. But now, we're going to do some updates. Hey, I mentioned Power Man and Iron Fist a couple episodes ago. We were talking about, you know, when did I decide that comics just weren't worth collecting anymore. And I mentioned my passion for Power Man and Iron Fist way back in the day. Well, actually, maybe not a passion. I mentioned that I even collected, that's how I phrased it, I even collected Power Man and Iron Fist. And loved them, by the way. And so Joel, I've mentioned Joel before, approaches me a while ago and says, so have you ever read the originals? Have you read the early stuff? I'm like, no. He says, hold on. Comes back the next day, and he has Power Man, the first 27 issues of Power Man. First it was Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, and then after about 16 issues it became Luke Cage, Power Man. And these things are awesome. I'm in about 9 issues so far. First off, it's a black and white comic, which I didn't even know that they did Power Man in black and white back then. It's from about 1971 is the first issue. And as I first get into it, my very first thought, flipping through the first couple issues, getting to read them, is holy cow, that's racist. Because for those of you who don't know, Luke Cage, Power Man, is a black man who was in prison for a crime he did not commit. And in order to help reduce his sentence, he agreed to a scientific experiment that went horribly wrong and allowed him to escape and left him with superpowers, etc., etc. And so he is now super strong, bulletproof. These are his superpowers. And he's decided to set himself up as a detective, and he is thus the hero for hire. He is a superhero detective. And again, a lot of the artwork, especially in the early issues, just seemed really really cartoonish and really, it seemed kind of racist. I mean, you know, the exaggerated black features. Apparently, this artist only knew how to draw one black hairstyle for women, and it's this giant fro, so every black woman looks nearly identical. It was just weird. And the jive talk, the black slang, the 70s slang, was all a little bit overdone. I mean, it just sounded a little off. But now, I mean, I 8, 9, 10 issues in, I've completely forgotten all of that, and I'm really enjoying it, because what you find out with Power Man is that, yeah, okay, it feels a little blaxploitation. And yes, because he is a superpowered detective, and so he's solving things detective style, it feels a little bit Scooby-Doo. You really expect the Mystery Machine to be pulling up in some of these episodes. But the writer clearly cared about this character and clearly was trying really hard. There was no intent to be racist. This was 40 years ago. This was the 70s. And it really, you get the love as you get into it. And I'm just saying, Power Man is badass. I love Power Man now more than I ever did. He is spectacular. So I'm really enjoying this. But more than that, even, combine the blaxploitation with some Iron Fist coming up, because Joel tells me he's got those too. Oh my God. So as soon as I get through all of Power Man, he's going to give me the martial arts exploitation comic book, Iron Fist. All right. So I get to see the origins of both of them before they finally combined my two favorite exploitation movies. Well, okay, except Women in Prison, but I don't know that they had a superhero for that. I don't know. They probably did. Someone informed me. But anyway, Power Man and Iron Fist, spectacular. So thank you, Joel. And also, I've referenced it several times, but let's make note that Nicolas Cage got his name from Luke Cage, Power Man. This is where it comes from. This is where that uber nerd named himself. So Power Man gets all the props from me. But enough of all that. It's time for the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If anything strikes me as interesting during the week, I add it to my master list, and the best stuff gets spewed out all over you every week when I record. You lucky dogs, you. So, straight into the master list, we're going to start off with the science corner.
Oh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
And that quote-unquote music from William Shatner means if you don't walk away now, you may be in danger of learning something. All right. My topic here says me and numbers. I was thinking about this because after last week's episode, I mentioned how appreciative I was that everyone had sent me so many Podomatic entries for the second half of the show. And when I listed how many I had, I noted immediately that there were 216, and then I said, right in the podcast, 216, why, that's 6 to the third power. It's 6 cubed. I was so excited. It felt, and I presented it as, 216, well, that's just auspicious. That's a sign of good fortune for our podcast, isn't it? And I wanted to explain that to you guys because it's something that goes on in my head all the time. I can't turn it off. I do this with numbers everywhere, and I'm not a superstitious person in general. I don't truly believe that 216 is any luckier or unluckier than any other number, but it's a pleasant number for me. I enjoy it because I see 216, and from working with probabilities and dice and knowing that when you roll three dice, there's 216 different possibilities, this is a number I've worked with a million times in my head, and so I recognize it right away. And then later, as I was adding some more to the Podomatic, I noticed that there were 222. All right, 222, not as good a number. It's a little awkward. It winds up being 2 times 3 times 37. My mind just breaks them down automatically, and that 37 makes it feel a little bit awkward. It's not the best composite number. But then I looked just now, and for today's podcast, we have 242. 242, that's 11 squared times 2. That one's a great one. And if we got even just one more would have made it 243, even better. That's 2. That's... Not 2, 3 to the 5th power is 243. So I love numbers. I love the feel of them. And specifically for me, I like the factors in them. I like to break them down into their factors and know, you know, if it's got a lot of low, little prime factors in it, you know, like 216, you know, it's all about 2s and 3s. That's beautiful to me. Something that has, you know, the bigger prime factors like 37, 43, whatever. A little more awkward for me, but you know, give me a number like 91. Oh, 91 is one of my favorite numbers. Not the favorite. Still haven't gotten to that one yet. But 91 is awesome because it's 7 times 13. It feels like it ought to be prime, and it's not. And yeah, you know what? There's maybe one person listening to this who even gets this, and everyone else is wondering why I don't just move on. But it's just one of those things that my mind does this constantly. And it reminds me of and it just feels weird, but I read a story a long time ago about a Dr. Oliver Sacks. And if you know Oliver Sacks, he was the doctor in the movie Awakenings with Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. That was Oliver Sacks, where that was based on him. Oliver Sacks writes all sorts of stuff about He does stuff about autism and perception and just odd tricks and games that the mind plays on itself. And one of my favorite stories from him is about a pair of autistic identical twins that he worked with. And these guys, if I remember the story correctly, it's been 15 years since I've read it. These two guys, they were adult men, identical twins, both severely autistic, both barely functional, okay? These were guys that could get themselves dressed. They could, you know, feed themselves, bathe themselves, but, you know, most of their daily routine was pretty basic. They weren't capable of holding down jobs and weren't capable of complicated stuff. From what I understand, their language skills were pretty limited. But these two would sit down and would rattle off numbers to each other. All right, and he observed them doing this on a regular basis. When they had time alone together, the two of them would sit down, and one of them would rattle off a string of six digits. He would rattle off a six-digit number. And then they'd both sit there and think about it for a little bit, and then they'd both giggle like crazy. And then the other one, well, he would list off his own six-digit number, a different number. And then they'd both think about it, and then they'd start giggling again. And so Dr. Sachs had a suspicion about it, and as soon as I'm reading the story, I had the exact same suspicion about it. Sure enough, he checks the numbers. He writes them all down. He checks the numbers that they're reading off to each other, and these numbers that they're reciting just out of their heads are all prime numbers. All right, he thinks this is funny. So Dr. Sachs decides to try an experiment of his own. He goes and picks out, because they've been doing six-digit numbers up till now, he picks out an eight-digit prime number. All right, he goes over to them. He waits until they've got a break in their conversation. And then he reads off this eight-digit number to them. And both of them just stare at him. And they stare. And then suddenly their eyes light up. And both of them start laughing and clapping. They're thrilled to death. He got it. He got the game. And he topped them. Something even better. So then he watches for the next half hour that they start spitting out eight-digit numbers at each other. Back and forth, back and forth. And then it starts growing. All right, 10 digits, 11, 13-digit prime numbers that these guys are just coming up with off the top of their head. And I can't even imagine. I mean, you know, like I say, I play this game in my own head, and I do this all the time. But the most I can work with in my own head is I recognize, you know, numbers up to about 300. I recognize most of them prime or know their factors with just, you know, a few seconds of thought. It's what I do. But that's just from years of practice, years of constantly working numbers with my head. And so I get those up to about 300. You know, I know most of them. And then beyond that, maybe, you know, you give me a few seconds of thought, maybe a minute, I can work them out. But, you know, it's a little harder for me there. But these guys are coming up with literally 13-digit numbers off the top of their head, and they both know that they're prime. And he takes the numbers back, and sure enough, he can confirm this later. But they're just doing it with mental math. I think it's tied to, and it just fascinates me, I think it's tied to the same way some autistic people can see calendars in their head. All right, they have the calendar in their head, and they can just see the patterns of it. So that you name a date any time in the last, you know, 3,000 years, you name the date, and they'll tell you what day of the week it was, because they can see the interwoven weeks that run through the patterns of the calendar. They can tell you what date Easter fell on. They can tell you, you know, the whole process, because they can see the cycles of it. They see the cycles of the 7-day week. They see the cycles of the moon that determine the months. They see the patterns of where the solstice falls and how Easter comes up and how, and I'm just amazed by that people just see that in their head. The whole calendar just rolls back behind them and ahead of them, and they can just visualize it and pick a spot anywhere. All right, it's like, and it reminds me of in the new Alice in Wonderland movie when they unroll the prophecy scroll. That's what it feels like to me, is that you just unroll this calendar and then boom, you just pick the date. Oh, look, there it is. That's what's going on. And so for these guys, I think it's the exact same thing, that they can look and see the weave of numbers, watch the ups and downs of the patterns of prime numbers and see where the gaps fall in between them, find new primes, and how they can track that out to 13 digits, more than that even, how they can follow, you know, hundreds, thousands of prime numbers in their head and just see that all at once just floors me. Oh my, I wish I could be in that mindset. I wish I could be in that head for just even 10 minutes just to see what that feels like. That just floors me. So, am I boring you yet? Oh, this stuff fascinates me. So that's why I give my number of the week. That's why I give the announcement. That's why you'll hear me read these things off, because I just love this kind of stuff. Fascinates me. Who wants to see what's on my gaming table? I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die. Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, I'm going to share it with you. And this week, I have occasion to start thinking about broken characters. All right, broken characters in role-playing games. Because it occurs to me, and I've had this discussion before, but it occurs to me that my favorite characters from almost any game I play are the ones that are really broken. The ones that are designed from the ground up with huge, tragic flaws in them. That's what makes a character interesting to me. That's what makes it the most playable for me, is having that design flaw in it. And it comes up because this week, as we're playing Archipelago, I don't mean to bore you with Archipelago again, but one of the characters in it, Sparrow, she's our pilot. And when I first saw the character design for Sparrow, I thought that she seemed a little too perfect. Okay, she's this tall, statuesque, I assume blonde from the way I'm picturing her. I don't know if that's specifically mentioned. But she is great in a fight. She is a crack pilot. She's just perfect at everything that she does. And it seemed to me, as I was reading her character, that she seemed a little too perfect. You know, it was just a little too much. I mean, he mentions in the description that, oh, she's got, you know, a bit of a temper. She acts before she thinks. But that seemed like a really weak kind of flaw to me. But, you know, it's a lie I had playing the character, and I trust him because I've seen what he can do before. And so, you know, I'm willing to give him the latitude to do whatever he wants. And as it turns out, in actual gameplay, oh, she's broken. You know why? Because she's a bitch. Oh my God. She's got this when he says short-tempered and, you know, acts before she thinks, this kind of stuff, he is not kidding. I mean, she just flies off the handle. She is just real quick temper, real, and I'm like, yeah, that's going to get her in a lot of trouble. That's something that, as a game master at least, oh, I can really work with that. I can play off of that. This is fascinating to me. And so it got me to thinking about broken characters like that. My own character for the game is kind of half of a savant himself and incredibly socially awkward, and I'm looking forward to getting my turn to play to be able to see how that develops further. But going back, you know, there's a temptation when you play role-playing games that you don't want to fail. Everyone wants to succeed. And so therefore, there's this tendency to want to create the best character possible. You know, if you're playing Dungeons & Dragons, then okay, if I'm a thief, I have to have that 18 dexterity. If I'm a wizard, I have to have that 18 intelligence. If I don't have my 18, it's just not a complete character, right? And yeah, okay, you might have your dump stat, but even then, your dump stat, your low stat, where you steal all your points from, is still, you know, what, 9, 10, that's your low stat? That's not low. All right, 6, that's low in Dungeons & Dragons. That's a broken character. Someone walking around with a 6 intelligence or a 6 charisma or a 6 anything, that's someone who's got some real serious in-game problems as a result of their stats. That's where you've built in the flaws. And so as much as people want that winning character, they want that character who is ready for every situation, who's good at everything he tries. Well, that's good if your goal is to win every battle and amass the most treasure, and, you know, that's great if you're playing a video game, but my goal is to tell a good story. And in a good story, it's about failing as much as it is about winning. All right? It's about the problems that you overcome as much as it is the successes that you score. And so I started thinking back to some of my favorites. And the first time that this really came to light to me, I've always been this way. I've always, you know, liked the more damaged characters. But the first time it was really highlighted for me in a strong way, I was playing a game of Paranoia a few years ago. And my cousin, Rob, he played a character who could turn invisible. That was his mutant power, invisibility. And out of nowhere, he says, okay, I can go invisible. I get that. But I want something bad to go with it. Like, every time I turn invisible, I get really bad gas. That was his ability, okay? And it was a minor thing. I mean, he was also, the character was kind of a lunkhead, kind of, you know, not big on the brains department, you know, big, tough, you know, Jethro Bodine-style character. And what would happen is he would turn invisible, and then while he's invisible, he could not stop himself from farting. All right, that to me was hysterical. That was something I could work with. And we played it all the way through. I mean, and so every time he goes invisible, he'd have these long descriptions of him trying to hold it in, and he's squeaking out these little farts, and, oh, everyone around him is getting disturbed because there's this smell, and they don't know where it's coming from. That's funny stuff. That's a good broken character. After that, my brother played a character in one of our D&D games where he played a dwarf who was just socially stunted. I mean, she was hideously ugly. She had been outcast from her tribe, so she's been banished. She's been, as part of being outcast, she wound up being shaved and scarred, and so she now, this ugly, twisted, bald, scarred female dwarf. And that is, you know, the face that she has to put forward going into every town, into every social encounter. And you know, she had a personality to match it because she was extremely bitter and upset. And so what a great character to play. You know, decent with her magic, decent in combat, had a lot of advantages going for her. But when it came to any kind of social situation, completely broken. I love that kind of character. And so for those of you listening, you know, if you're, especially because I find that newer players, and I'll have more about this next week, but I find newer players are coming to role-playing games for the first time with a very World of Warcraft kind of attitude. They're coming into it as if role-playing games are video games. And so I wind up getting this kind of question, you know, they go into the store for the first time, and quite literally I get asked, so how many weapon slots do I have? That's what you're worried about? I mean, look, you've got this beautiful magic sword with all this history and this family connection. You've got this beautiful magic sword. You have your bow. You've got, you know, a dagger hidden in your boot, because everyone's got a dagger hidden in their boot, right? And, you know, you've got your basic weapons. But he's like, okay, well, what's available in the store? How many weapon slots do I have? How many weapons can I carry? I want to fill them all up. As if he's going to get in combat, and then suddenly he's going to start pressing the X button to rotate through his weapons. Well, that's not how combat works in D&D. That's not, you know, you don't go into a fight looking for your best selection of weapon for the moment. No, you have your sword. You have your bow. That's what you carry. And the idea that you're coming into it looking for that sort of advantage was just alien to me. It had never even occurred to me, but I've seen it a couple of times now. And it's something that, you know, eventually they work past it. They start playing the game. They realize what the story is about, what the characters are about, and they learn pretty quickly, and they move past that. But for the new players, it was a really tough sell to try and get them to take flaws. I mean, even though, you know, D&D does not build in flaws to the characters for the most part. I mean, you know, you have high stats or low stats. You have either skills you've taken or skills you haven't taken. It doesn't really build in a whole lot of personality flaws, a lot of serious drawbacks that you have to deal with. But I encourage my characters, my players, when they create their characters, I encourage them to build those things in, to design a personality and a history that give them things to work around, things that they're dealing with and having trouble with. I mean, so in my D&D group, you know, one of them has, his family's been slaughtered, and so therefore he has this whole vengeance thing going on, very stereotypical sort of thing. But it works, and it motivates him. The other one was wrongly cast out from his people, and so now he's also, he thinks he may be half demon possessed, and he's kind of working through not being evil. You know, everyone's got their things, and it's not stuff that Dungeons & Dragons builds into, or Pathfinder in this case. It's not stuff that they build into their game, but we certainly put it in there because it just makes a better game. That's my goal, is to tell a great story, and my goal is for everyone to have fun. And as it turns out, they have a lot more fun when their characters are flawed. And so I recommend it. All right, but now it's time for a Nerd Culture Report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
No, Gonzo, not even close. What we're talking about this week is speech and one act. These are competitions that my children participate in high school. One act is the one act plays, which they put on a one act play. It's about 30 minutes long, and they take it to competition. And just recently, my two oldest sons and all of their friends and their one act play went to state competition, and we are so amazingly proud of them. And they scored third in state, which is amazing. And we're really, really proud of them. But it taught me a lesson about the nature of competition at any level. Now, what I'm most familiar with is competition at the high school level, because, you know, we go see the wrestling meets and the football games and the one-act competition, and my kids are also in speech competitions. So I see the high school stuff, but this applies anywhere. With one-act and speech especially, I've discovered that I have no idea how they score these things. All right, clearly, I saw our school perform, and by the end, it was very clear to me that our school was vastly superior to everybody else and clearly should have won. The judges felt slightly differently, but as I looked back, I just have no idea what they're looking for, because there were parts of, you know, some of the winning plays, there were parts of them where I'm like, you know, but they made such an obvious trip here. had some real obvious gaffes where the actors just completely forgot lines, didn't even cover it. They just forgot their lines, so they backed up and started over. And yet they won. They did better than us. So I don't know what else they had going for them. I don't know what else happened that made them the superior team in the judges' eyes. But that's beside the point. Look, third is nothing to sneeze at. And I am very, very proud of them. And the fact that I don't understand the scoring system doesn't mean it doesn't ultimately all work out fairly. But what did strike me through this whole process is listening to how people complain, listening to people who are just upset because, you know what, the judges were just unfair to us. Oh, the judges just, but, or another one from one of the adults there who, like me, was a little baffled by the scoring, and therefore he said, you know, that's why I prefer wrestling. You know, wrestling, it's just you against another guy. It's one-on-one, and either you take him down or you don't. The points are all really obvious. There's no question what's going on. And I thought, really? I've been to wrestling meets. Have you seen how many people argue with the judges? Have you seen how many people afterwards, even if they don't argue with the judges, how many people afterwards complain that, yeah, but he touched out. I should have had that point. I can't believe they didn't call that, right? Or our last football game where our football team didn't make it to state this year, but we were really close. And in our final game of the season, we wound up, they were just the better team. But they had this horrible, horrible turnover in the third quarter where suddenly we gave up three touchdowns in like 4 minutes and they just clobbered us, which was some bad luck and other stuff going on. But even before that, you know, they'd been outplaying us from the beginning of the game and we were just lucky to hold on as long as we did. But after that big turnover, even as we're sitting there and then for days afterwards, there was all this talk about how, you know, if the refs hadn't been against us, this is just like last year when the refs, you know, those bad calls that they were making, you know what? It's everywhere. And every time someone loses, every time something's going against you in a competition, it is human nature to want to find someone else to blame. It's human nature. If there is any measure of subjective judgment that goes into a competition, then someone, usually a lot of someone's, are going to find a way to blame that judgment call for why they're losing. You know what? In every case, in almost all cases, it's as fair as it's going to get. And, you know, in the case of our football team, the better team won. All right? In the case of our one-act play, I didn't see it. I still maintain that we were the better play, but I'm not going to argue with the process. That's the way it's set up. The judges are there to do their job. I'm not going to sit there and think that someone was biased against us or that someone was out to get us or any of that. It's odd to see the similarities across it that, you know what, they beat us fair and square. That's just the way the world works. But as much as people think that there's this big difference between jocks and the geeks and that, you know, one side thinks they're so much better than anybody else. You know what? We all do the exact same stuff. We all react the exact same way. And to me, you know what? I'm just proud that we all did our best. And that sounds corny and cheesy, but they really did. If you had seen this play, I am not kidding when I say it was the best in my opinion. I think every single one of our players on that stage gave everything they had. I mean, the emotion pouring out of them during this performance was just unreal. I wish I had a tape of their final performances so that I could post them up somewhere because they were wonderful, really, really wonderful. And that was enough for me. All right, hey, we took third and we got some outstanding actor awards and we got some recognition. That's more than enough because that is a huge accomplishment. I was thrilled to death. But enough of my family. Now it's time for What's on Television.
No, no. It's just as seen on TV.
Just as seen on TV. Okay, I haven't actually watched it yet, but did you know that there's a new Last Airbender series coming out this summer? I mean, in like 6 months, we're going to have a new Airbender series, The Legend of Korra. Did you know that? And if you did, why didn't you tell me? I told my kids this, and my 13-year-old says, oh, yeah, well, we knew that. What? Why didn't you tell me? Are you kidding with me? I am so stoked. All right. I was out on some other forum. I saw someone link to a new Airbender and clicked on the link with all sorts of trepidation because I was just positive it was going to be the next M. Night Shyamalan ding dong thing. And I really don't want to see another live-action Airbender. But no, it's not a new live-action Airbender. It's a new cartoon. It's from Nickelodeon Animation Studios. I'm so excited! I can't tell you what this means. And, all right, first off, if you haven't seen the first Airbender TV show, go watch it now. Last time I looked, it was streaming on Netflix Instant Watch. You want to watch it. It's awesome, the entire thing. Once we found it, my wife and I consumed this thing in a matter of weeks. We went through everything all at once and just loved it to death. I was completely sold on the characters, completely sold on the story. Wonderful, wonderful show. And so now, for those of you who are familiar with it, the new series, I was just amazed at how ambitious they are about this story. It's called The Legend of Korra. This takes place 70 years after the first story. So 70 years later, Aang, the star of the first series, is dead. He's gone. All right, he's dead, and a new avatar has taken his place. The new avatar is a young waterbender named Korra. There you go, The Legend of Korra. And Korra, she has mastered three of the elements. She's working on mastering the fourth, which is air. And again, my second son, Ataian, he says to me, yeah, but Aang was the last airbender. Remember, that was the whole point of it. That's why they named it The Last Airbender, because he was the last one. Where is she going to learn her airbending from? He has to be dead for her to be the avatar. Where is she going to learn her airbending? Well, from Aang's grandson, of course. Well, just because he was the last airbender doesn't mean that he couldn't then create more, right? All right, and so it is 70 years in the future, which means that they've actually taken the pains to update the world by 70 years worth of technology and development. They've changed the culture so that now instead of having such discrete separate nations, the Earth Nation, the Fire Nation, the Water Nation, there's more blending. It's a more cosmopolitan feel as they come together and work together. 70 years has given them what's being described as a steampunk sort of world, taking the best and most productive elements of the Fire Nation steampunk from the first show and developing that and showing what the world looks like in a steampunk environment 70 years later. Now, there was a lot more stuff written, a lot more teasers and spoilers and stuff like this, and I decided I had to stop reading there because I don't want to ruin the whole thing. That's it. That's all the information I know. All right, it's going to be 70 years from now, new avatar named Korra, Aang's grandson, steampunk. I'm happy. I cannot wait. And when it comes out, you know I will come tell you about it. This is going to be awesome. So what do we have that can follow up a new Airbender show?
And now for something completely different.
All right, something completely different. My kids were out watching Rise of the Planet of the Apes with a bunch of friends. This was, in fact, after the one-act state competition. They had a big party to celebrate their third-place win. They all went back and, you know, they partied, they ate. And then towards the end of the night, they all sat down and they watched Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the new one. And the interesting part of this, and I'm getting all of this secondhand from my sons. I wasn't there. I was invited, but I was so tired. And what they're telling me is that during the movie, one of the girls who was in the play with them, one of the girls who was there with them watching the movie, happens to be a fluent speaker of sign language. And so therefore, as the movie's going on, there would be certain times in the movie where Caesar, I think that's the chimp's name, Caesar would say something in sign language, and usually they subtitled it, but they didn't always. So it would be times that he would say something, there's no subtitle, and then this girl, watching the movie with him, would go, "Oh," and they'd be, "What? What?" So she wound up being the default interpreter for the movie. So every time Caesar says something and there's no translation provided, she would then translate for him. And so, you know, Caesar signs something. She goes, "Oh, that's so sad. What? What's he saying?" "Well, he's asking where his parents are." And so sure enough, right after that, the actor opposite Caesar says, "Oh, you want to know where you came from?" Okay, so they play into this. And to me, the funniest part of this story is at the end, as the big thing is building and the apes are rebelling, and it shows all the apes standing out in the open. They're all screaming, and they're pounding the ground. And that's when the girl pipes up and says, "Yeah, that means they're pissed off." And I thought that was really funny. So that was just my cute little Rise of the Planet of the Apes story. Do I have anything else?
And now for something completely different.
Oh, something completely different from that even. Yet another personal tale. This is the tale of Hobo Steve. Hobo Steve is awesome. My wife teaches in the same elementary school where two of my sons go, and she's sitting at her desk the other day, and one of the kindergarten teachers or kindergarten aides, I can't remember, but somebody from the kindergarten room comes in and looks at my wife and says, I don't want to be weird, but who is Steve? And my wife thinks. And finally, after a bit, she says, Steve's the hobo who lives in our attic. And the teacher says, oh, all right, well, that's what he told us. Okay, thanks. And then leaves. All right, so here's the deal. Hobo Steve, we keep all of our Christmas presents in the attic. That's where we hide everything, is up in the attic. And a few weeks ago, out of nowhere, the little kids, and they do this every single year. They always, because I'm constantly going up to the attic to, you know, put new presents up there or check to make sure that we've got something or whatever. And every time that door is open, the little kids want to know if they can go up to the attic. Can I go up and see the attic? Can I go up? They don't want to see the attic any other time of the year. But come Christmas time, they are desperate to go up there. And so my wife explains, no, of course you can't go up there. The Christmas presents are up there. And somehow she works in the joke that you know, but because the kids are wondering, well, how are they going to know if we go up there? And she explains, well, because the hobo that lives in our attic is going to spot you if you go up there, and he'll make sure he tells us. Right. Why a hobo? Well, we live right across the street from the railroad tracks, so it would only be natural that the hobos would stop here and that we'd have one living in our attic. And so she winds up telling them that there's a hobo living in our attic. Oh, yeah, he lives behind the boxes up there, and he's watching. And if you go up there, he'll tell us. And so, and the kids understand that this is a huge joke, or at least I hope they understand. Either way, it's really, really funny. And at some point they asked, well, what's his name? And she says, Steve, because it was the first name that she thought of. And so now we've been making this huge joke about Hobo Steve living in our attic. Don't think another thing of it. And then the kindergartner goes to school, and I can only imagine how this had to look to his teachers. He actually draws in his daily journal, he draws a picture of himself and his father, me, and the two of us are running somewhere. It looks like we're running away, and there's a bunch of boxes piled up, and you can see in this... Hold on. That's my ringtone. I'll be right back. And then, on the other side of the picture, is a bunch of boxes piled up, right? And from behind the boxes, you can see a head poking up, and the head has one hand up, and he's putting a finger to his lips to go, shh, okay. And it all looks really creepy, and it's hard to tell. It looks like we, in the picture, me and him, are running away from whoever that is. So now, you got to imagine that my son has now drawn this picture of a creepy guy hiding behind boxes, telling everyone to be quiet, while him and his dad are running away from this figure. And when they ask him, so tell me about this picture. Oh, that's me and my dad? Uh-huh. And who's this over here? Well, that's Steve. Who's Steve? Steve's the hobo that lives in our attic. So what are you guys doing? As it turns out, as he explains the picture further, it turns out that we were actually looking for Steve. We were trying to find him, but Steve, of course, always hides behind his boxes. And to me, I just think that had to be the most comical scene. I wish I could have been there. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall for that, because that's just creepy. Little kid drawing that picture, and he says just such a casual explanation. Oh, no, that's Hobo Steve. So I don't know how I'm going to work Hobo Steve into other stuff, but I have got to keep him around because I love Hobo Steve. And you know what? I was going to follow it up with some nerd rage. I was actually going to talk about – well, I'm not even going to tell you what I'm going to talk about because I've run out of time for the meticulously plotted portion. I will save my rage for next week, and you guys can be thrilled by it then. And in the meantime, we're just going to move on and do a little bit of music. This is a band called AWOL Nation. Now, AWOL Nation spells AWOL Nation all in caps. That's how they write their name. And to me, I would have assumed with a name like AWOL Nation in all caps, I would have assumed it was some kind of heavy metal band, some hard rock, heavy metal, something that I would hear on the Octane station on satellite radio. As it turns out, they're not. And you'll hear their style in a little bit. But I found out we wound up buying the entire album of AWOL Nation because between my wife and I, there were like, you know, four or five songs that we really liked. And we're like, you know, once we've bought that many, just buy the whole darn album. So we bought the entire album. And now when the songs come up in the mix, I like all of them. I like the entire album. I have such a hard time deciding what songs to even put on here because they're all really good. All right. And I'm going to give you the first one, which I think has gotten some airplay or some feature in some TV show or movie or other. So I think it's around a little bit more. It's got some exposure. But this first one is called Sail. Listen to this one. I love this song. That song just tickles me. I love that song. And there's something about AWOL Nation that everything I listen to of theirs, not so much Sale, most of their other songs, though, every time I hear a song by them, I get this vibe, like it's almost like I've heard the song before. It sounds vaguely familiar. It's got this not quite, but almost an 80s vibe to it that feels like, God, are they taking that riff from some old 80s song? Did they pick up that line from somewhere else? It's all just vaguely familiar and yet not, and just intrigues me. I love listening to AWOL Nation. I highly recommend them. So, and we'll get another one from them in just a minute. But before that, it's time for the badass movie quote of the week. This one comes from the movie V for Vendetta. Now, this is Hugo Weaving being as completely badass as possible. All right. What you have are bullets and the hope that when your guns are empty, I'm no longer standing. Because if I am, you'll all be dead before you've reloaded. Hugo Weaving is badass even when you can't see his face. I am amazed at that role because you never see the man. I wouldn't even have known it was him except that, you know, he was there in the credits. But great movie, V for Vendetta. Great comic book movie. And spectacularly good quotes. There's good dialogue, good quotable material all the way through this thing. So go watch V for Vendetta. And now we will do a little bit more music. This is another one for AWOL Nation, again. And this one is... I have this suspicion that it's not the best song that they do. Maybe even not even, you know, the second or third best song that they do. But it's my favorite. I can't get enough of this song. There's something cheesy and 80s about it, and yet it completely hooks me. I'm totally sucked into this song, and I fall for it every time. It's called All I Need. Gets me every time. I hope it does the same for you. AWOL Nation, check them out. And now it's time for the Pod-O-Matic. Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. If you want to hear me haver on about something, you need to send your questions, your topics to me by email, or, better yet, send them to me in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. As I mentioned earlier in the cast, I am up to 242 entries, and I just note in my email that Paul has sent me another batch. So at this point, it's probably up to 500 the way Paul's been going. I have got a lot of stuff, and we'll get right into it with number 22. Thank you, R2. Number 22 is from Brasky, and Brasky says, "Have you seen Warehouse 13? It's on Netflix Instant, and I'm almost done with season 2. It's awesome. Awesome. It's the tongue-in-cheek humor of Buffy or Firefly, but with a Men in Black sci-fi text to it, so it's awesome." Wow. No, I haven't watched it. I really ought to. Yancey has also raved about that show. I've heard very good things from other people. I will go do that. I am actually, right now, since you mentioned Firefly, I'm actually watching Firefly again right now. I had been watching Full Metal Alchemist, obviously, and I've kind of faded back on that one. It's just not as exciting anymore. But because of Archipelago, I am watching Firefly, and I'm watching about an episode every day or two, and I've seen Firefly a couple times before already, but I love Firefly. It's just inspiring. It's awesome. So if you're going to give me something that is similar to that, then, all right, give me this weekend. I will, I'll start watching. I'll check it out and see what you're saying. Thank you. 46. This one is from Jeff Hawes. Jeff Hawes says, "Your most recent nightmare. And if it doesn't involve me, I'm quitting the site, and I mean it this time." Oh, geez, my most recent nightmare? This is not 5 days ago. I had a dream that I was in high school. I was in my kids' high school, and I was going in to take a history test for which I was completely and woefully unprepared. I had my assignment or study guide or whatever it was filled out, and no, that's not the sheet you needed. Where's the other sheet? I don't know what sheet you're talking about. I haven't had dreams about being back in school for years. Oh, it was frightening. And it all stems from the fact that both of my older kids have the same history teacher, one for American history, one for world history, and it seems like every week I am helping one of them study for a history test, and this material just, there's so much of it. And, I'm a lover of history. I really enjoy it. And there's, when we're studying, I find myself going off on tangents a lot. You can imagine how I do, because there's lots of things I love exploring, but we also have to make sure we hit all of the material that's really going to be on the test. And it's just a lot. It's intensive. So I know where the dream came from. I know why it happened. And I was surprised at how absolutely frightening and horrifying it was to feel like you're back in school, you're taking a test, you have no idea. The only way it could have been worse is if not only had I not studied for the test, but I was also wandering the halls and couldn't find my room, and then found out I wasn't wearing any pants. That's how bad it was. Oh yeah, and Jeff was there? Whew, covered that one just in time. 15. This one is from Scree. Hey, hello, Scree. Good to see you again. Scree says, "Star Wars or Star Trek, which is better and why?" Well, I can't choose. I'm not going to choose. They're so very different in intent and style that they're each good for different reasons. I think Star Wars, if you look at the entirety of Star Wars, then so I'm including not just the movies, which have some issues, obviously, but also, the books and the other materials and everything that goes together with Star Wars. There's so much epic space opera stuff there that it's hard not to find something that you like in all that. There's so much really good, kick-ass, cool stuff in Star Wars. And Star Wars is made for epic stories of heroes and, saving the world. And there's so much big stuff going on in it. It's a very different kind of story because it's really... and this is cliche to say it, but it is really more of a fantasy epic than it is a science fiction tale in a lot of ways. Whereas Star Trek, I loves me some Star Trek. I adore Star Trek. I am such a nut about it. But Star Trek is not the same kind of story. Star Trek really is focusing on exploration of human nature. It's exploration of the human condition using science fiction analogs, using these people of the future and their science fiction races and technologies and things that we encounter, and using those elements of science fiction to make comparisons back to modern day humans and the human condition in general. It's a very different exploration. And that's not to say that J.J. Abrams hasn't made a rousing action adventure film out of the first reimagined Star Trek movie, and that he probably will be doing the exact same thing for, you know, three or four more movies to come. But in its full intent, Star Trek is really not about the epic sweeping history, but it's about the individual characters and their interactions, and again, what that means to us. It's a very different sort of world. Again, they're both huge in their scope. They both have tons of movies. There's the TV series, there's the books, there's all this development and background material. There's hundreds of books written just talking about them, not even telling stories in that universe, but just talking about what this means or what that means, and how realistic is this technology and what can you do with it. There's so much out there. I'm really not going to pick one over the other, except to say that I love them both and they each serve a purpose. Star Trek. Bam! Number 71. Roll down to... This is from Sirius Paul. Hello, Paul. Which, by the way, Paul now owns half the entries on this list, so I am surprised it's taken us till the fourth one now to have him pop up. But Paul asks, are there any role-playing games in Russia? Well, there would have to be. There's role-playing games everywhere. And Oh, darn it. You know, I want to make a really horrible joke about, in Soviet Russia, games play you, but I can't really make that work because it's not funny, other than, oh, it's funny because he's referencing Yakov Smirnov. But it's not humorous in its own right. Role-playing games, there are role-playing games everywhere in the world. There have to be role-playing games in Russia because I used to do vanity searches for, not my own name because Mike Jones is way too common and all I get is the rapper, but I would do vanity searches looking for games and products that I've written, or doing searches for my podcast name. So I do a search for Instant Game, or a search for Beck's character delivery system for Shadowrun. And what I found was there were some of my games and my articles that had been translated into Russian. Oh, holy crap, really? Like Russian gaming web forums linking to my stuff. That's awesome. I love that. I found stuff from Sweden, obviously, but Zimny's there, so you can just assume that Zimny accounts for all of my Swedish fan base. And translations of stuff in Hebrew, honestly, so stuff from Israel, German websites that make references to my stuff, Russian websites, and not to say that anything I've done has been that earth-shaking or huge. I mean, you know, Instant Game, the thing I'm most proud of the gaming materials I've created, has had, you know, a couple thousand downloads total over its life. I don't know. My brother would know more detail of how many we got on the old site. But, you know, people handed it around, and people have gotten to play it, and we've gotten some really great feedback on it. And so the fact that it's been in other countries and other people have found it, that just thrills me to death. I think that stuff is great. I'm just so happy to see people enjoying things that I've made. And so therefore, the fact that a Russian website would translate my Shadowrun article into Russian means that they must play Shadowrun at the very least. In fact, I'm going to just make the blanket assumption that Shadowrun is the only game played in Russia, because it seems like their style. So there you go, Paul. Yes, yes, they do. R2 rolls up a 60. Good job, R2. This one is from Billy Bob. And Billy Bob gives us a Kiss, Marry, Kill. If I didn't explain the rules to Kiss, Marry, Kill last time because I just assume everyone knows it. The Kiss, Marry, Kill is the sanitized version of F, Marry, Kill. And so therefore, I will be given three options. And I have to choose from these three, one of whom I want to kiss, one of whom I would spend a wild night of passionate kissing with. Then I have to pick one that I would marry and live with for the rest of my life. And then the third one I would then have to kill. So the choices offered to me by Billy Bob are Bud Bundy from Married with Children. This is off to a poor start. Cliff Clavin from Cheers. Ooh, I know where I'm going with this. And, Oh, and Buddy from Charles in Charge. Oh, all right. This depends. Am I getting Buddy from Charles in Charge, or am I getting the actor Willie Ames? Because my answer will differ depending on whether I'm getting fun-loving Buddy or much less fun Bible Man. So I'm going to make the assumption on all three of these that I'm getting the actual character and not the actor. All right. And in that case, for kissing, if I'm forced to choose between Bud Bundy, Cliff Clavin, and Buddy, I don't know Buddy's last name. It's not listed here. I'm going to have to go with Buddy for the kissing. He seemed like a party animal kind of guy. He was always trying to get Charles in trouble. He seems like the kind of guy that would be out for just a little bit of fun, right? I mean, now, so was Bud Bundy, but Bud was a little sleazier. All right, I don't know that I could even spend much time with Bud Bundy, much less kiss him. So, yeah, it's going to have to be Buddy. So then, that leaves me really no choice. I would have to marry Cliff Clavin, and I have no problem with that because Cliff Clavin is just chock full of trivia. Cliff Clavin is just a font of knowledge. I would have so much fun talking to Cliff Clavin probably for about an hour, and then he'd start to piss me off because he just won't shut up. But really, I think that's my best choice. So I would have to kiss Buddy from Charles in Charge, marry Cliff Clavin, and that leaves me only to kill Bud Bundy, and who hasn't wanted to do that? David Faustino, by the way, is the actor who I have no idea if he's any better, but you certainly want to kill Bud Bundy. 91 is from Stan. And Stan, okay, I'm going to assume that this was a follow-up to another question sent to me by Stan, because people just send me lists of questions, and then I just pop them into a spreadsheet and I shuffle them. So if this went with a previous question, I'm sorry, I don't know what it was. The question simply says, how often? I can only imagine what you're asking me how often for, because it certainly doesn't apply to my kiss, marry, kill from the last question. So I'm going to recommend at least once a year, probably on an as-needed basis, you know, in case you're noticing wear and tear. But at a minimum, even if you don't think it needs it, at least once a year. That's just to be safe. Bing, number 17. Where 17 is from? Number 17 is from Talvin. I don't think we've had any repeats so far. This is really cool. Talvin says, if you could take one classic D&D spell and bring it to life in the real world, what spell would it be? Please say Mordekainen's Magnificent Mansion. And you know what? I can't think of any spells off the top of my head other than Fireball and Cure Light Wounds. So since you've done the thinking for me, I can't do anything better than Mordekainen's Magnificent Mansion. How awesome is that spell? How cool is that to create your own extra-dimensional space in which to live? I have always dreamed of having an extra-dimensional space of my own. I really have. This is the kind of thing that I would dream about. The idea that I've got a box or a house or a container of some sort that is larger on the inside than it is on the outside, that makes me happy. Oh, that tickles me in ways I can't even describe. That would be really cool. There are lots of other things I would love to be able to do with some D&D spells. I would love to be able to fly or spider climb or certainly cast fireballs. Would be really impressive for, you know, until I burn the house down. Curing wounds would be awesome. Prismatic spray, just because it's really showy. Power word kill. Man, it would be nice to know that you had the ability, but boy, it's too tempting to use it. But all of that stuff, any D&D spell would be awesome to have. But boy, Mordekainen's Magnificent Mansion is really hard to top, Talvin. I think you have really, really topped this one. I'm not going to argue with you at all. Number 94. And, okay, after I say something, now we get our first repeat. This one is from Brasky. Brasky says, do you like processed cheese a lot? Please answer before reading on. Okay, yeah, yes, I love processed cheese. Now, by processed cheese, do you mean like spray cheese in a can, which is processed cheese, which I love? Or do you mean Velveeta, which is also processed cheese, which I love? Or most American cheeses, which, you know, Kraft processed American food cheese slices? I don't know what they call them. Because if so, I love any and all of them. My answer is an unqualified yes. Brasky then continues on and says, oh, really? We'll name 8 different ways to enjoy it. Oh, all right, well, let's start with the spray cheese. First off, you can eat spray cheese straight out of the can. That is incredible. And you never want anyone to catch you doing it because it's kind of gross that, you know, you're probably going to put your lips on the thing. But I love spray cheese straight from the can. Or you can put spray cheese on any kind of cracker at all. That's number two. 2A would then be, if you're actually putting your spray cheese on crackers, try using your spray cheese nozzle to drill a little tiny hole through the cracker from the backside. All right, and so it looks like the cracker's not broken, but it actually is. And then you hit the spray nozzle, and then your cheese comes shooting up through the hole in your cracker, and it kind of spirals and just lays itself neatly around in a big circle, a donut of cheese on your cracker. It's really cool. All right, or you could also take your spray cheese, and you could put it onto celery. That's actually the best way. If you're going to put it on vegetables, spray cheese is a great way to make those disgusting, nasty vegetables a little more palatable. So a little spray cheese on your celery. Healthier snack, because healthy celery, really unhealthy spray cheese. Or you can use spray cheese to grout your tub. Actually, spray cheese, take the can and put a little bit on top of your deviled egg. Oh my God, that is so good and so incredibly cholesterol-filled and yet wonderful. If you've got a block of Velveeta, dice up your Velveeta and throw the cubes into your chili. That's the most obvious one. Or you slice up your Velveeta and you make grilled cheese sandwiches out of it. And oh my God. Yesterday, as a thank you, I helped someone with some photo editing and cropping, and that she was trying to put together a poster because she wants to order this poster for her father-in-law for a Christmas gift. So I help her put the whole thing together, and it took a while. And then she shows up later in the day with a loaf of garlic cheddar bread. It's like this homemade or Amish crafted bread. I don't know where it came from, but she got it from some market somewhere. But it's a garlic cheddar bread. And so I brought that sucker home and sliced the bread thin and then buttered it up, dropped a little Velveeta on it, and grilled it and made grilled cheese sandwiches with garlic cheddar bread. It was the best thing ever. Oh, that was so good. All right, so you can drop your Velveeta in the chili. You can slice up your Velveeta, and you can make grilled cheese sandwiches out of it. Or, for that matter, and you can do this with American cheese too, grilled cheese sandwiches. Or you can do put it on crackers plain, or put it on saltine crackers and put them in the microwave so the cheese melts. Because especially American craft slices, they taste a little bit different when they've been melted and microwaved. Really good. Or just two slices of American cheese, slap them between two slices of bread, throw them in the microwave for 17 seconds. Boom. Perfect melty, cheesy snack. Or, you know what? Even better than bread, get yourself a pita pocket or just a couple of tortillas, flour tortillas. Throw some cheese between those and heat it up a little microwave quesadilla. Add a little salsa to it if you need it. Spice it up. That is really good stuff. How many ways am I up to using cheese at this point? Because I haven't even gotten to taking Velveeta, and you dice that up and use it as the base of Logue's favorite potato soup. Logue, our 8-year-old, when he was very little, we made this potato soup from a new recipe. And it is Velveeta, and it's cream cheese, and you throw that into a pot with some, you know, chicken broth and, oh, what else? Oh, and just a bag of hash brown potatoes, and the thing is wonderful. I should post the recipe up on the website so you guys can see it, because it is fattening and unhealthy and terrible for you, but it is the best tasting cheesy potato soup you've ever had in your life. You will thank me for it. It is so good. Okay, American slices are also handy for making macaroni and cheese. Now, you can make homemade macaroni and cheese with Velveeta. That's the best way to make homemade macaroni and cheese. Or macaroni and cheese with corn in it, which is even better. Holy cow. But if you make regular Kraft macaroni and cheese out of the box, then when you get done, for every box of macaroni and cheese you've made, after you've made it and it's nice and cheesy and perfect, throw in one extra slice of Kraft American cheese. That is perfect. And then American slices also work as a good refresher for your mac and cheese, because I don't know if you've ever noticed, I don't know if you eat leftover mac and cheese, but if you put mac and cheese in a container, you put it in your Tupperware dish in the fridge overnight, and then you go to have it for lunch the next day, you heat it up and it's just a little dried out, and the flavor seems to have faded. The flavor is it's not as cheesy as it was the day before. So when you throw it in the microwave, throw in an extra slice of cheese with your serving of mac and cheese, heat it up, and then that melty cheese will A, freshen it up, and B, bring some of that flavor back. It's really, really good. Clearly, I could go on about unhealthy processed cheese forever, but I think we've gotten the idea. Number 74. Hey, look at that. We have a straggler from Anonymous. Thank you, Anonymous. Anonymous says, what is your best imaginary friend story? All right. I had lots of imaginary friends when I was a kid because, yeah, I was too socially awkward to have real friends. But my oldest son, Gygax, had an imaginary friend when he was young. And I would imagine that Gygax was 5 or 6 at the time. I don't remember. But he had an imaginary friend named Michael. And Michael was occasionally rude. Michael, well, and also Super Dinosaur. Super Dinosaur got banished from our family a while back because Gygax would be extremely naughty, especially at the babysitter. And then whatever it was that he got in trouble for, he would explain to us that, Super Dinosaur did it. Super Dinosaur called the babysitter horrible names. And so Gygax had to go explain to her that, well, yeah, you know what? This wasn't me, but Super Dinosaur said, you're a bitch. Oh, he got in so much trouble for that. But Super Dinosaur we banished, and then Michael was the next imaginary friend. And Gygax was acting up in the backseat of the van, and we were telling him to knock it off, and we were telling him to knock it off, and he just wouldn't. And so he finally explained to us that... But it's Michael. Michael's poking me. Michael's the one doing it. And whatever it was that he was doing to get himself in trouble, well, it was Michael who was causing the trouble. So we said, okay, fine. That's it. We pulled the car over to the side of the road, got out and opened the door, and we told Michael to get out. And we left the imaginary friend there by the side of the road. We shut the doors. We drive on home. Gygax is looking sadly out the back window the entire time. Now, we thought it was a funny joke that we made the imaginary friend get out of the car. But as it turns out, he never came back. That was it. I mean, and later, we asked him about it. We said, so whatever happened to Michael? Well, you made him get out. He remembered it, and he never gave him, we never went back to pick him up. So we've now made the joke every time we drive by that spot. Oh, everyone waved to Michael. He's still waiting there for us. So that's my best imaginary friend story, is we kicked him out, and honest to God, the poor kid actually lost his imaginary friend. We thought it was funny. We thought we were joking. No, apparently we were being very cruel and inhumane parents because his bestest friend in the whole world was just gone. Number 94, we've already done. Number 56, that's better. And this is another one from Serious Paul. Serious Paul says, replace one member of the A-Team with one member of Kid Video. Does anyone even remember Kid Video? I have. All right, I'll do it. I would first off take out Murdoch from the A-Team. I'm assuming we're going the original A-Team, not the movie version of the A-Team. I would take out Murdoch simply because he was my least favorite. I get the whole crazy shtick, whatever. I was not entertained. And instead, we're going to replace Murdoch with the nerd from Kid Video. Whizzer, what was that his name? Something like that. But replace him with the nerd who was... I can't even remember what instrument he played. But replace him with the nerd and make sure that the nerd gets to bring his robot with him, Toolbot. That one I remember, right? And I think that would bring a little of the nerd presence to the A-Team. It kind of needs it. I mean, because you can't get rid of Face. You can't get rid of George Peppard. You certainly can't get rid of Mr. T. So it's got to be Murdoch. And so we'll get Murdoch out, bring in a real nerd, someone who can get something accomplished, right? Good. I think we're done. This podcast is copyright 2011 by Nerd Pride Radio. The featured music this week was AWOL Nation with their song Sail and All I Need. The opening and closing theme is from the Beastie Boys Sabotage as performed by the Penelopes. The bumper clips are taken from She Blinded Me with Science by William Shatner, As Seen on TV by White Apple Tree, and Words by Missing Person. All bumper music is available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. I would not put them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes. Write a nice review of us, or if you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is come sign up for our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up, send me a message, hang out. We'll have fun. got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided dice. I've got Kitty Pride and Nightcrawler 2 waiting there for me. Yes, I do. Yes, I do.